Okay, while the last people are finding their space in the floor, the subject for this evening is another request. This time that somebody sent a letter from the Netherlands. It was a young English man studying over there who's been listening to all these talks on the internet. It's amazing just how many of these talks on a Friday night go all around the world. First of all, just on audio, and now on the webcam. So we've got a huge audience. And this particular person, a young man who's now got very interested in Buddhism, asked me a question which I thought was worthy of addressing on a Friday night. It's an old question, but a powerful one. And I'm going to answer it in a different way than I've answered before, because all these talks are, you know, ad hoc. The particular question was that he's come across our tradition, Theravada forest tradition, originated in Thailand, and he's come across other traditions as well, especially the Mahayana, and he's read many books, and he's said, what's the difference between all these traditions? Is there a difference? And how do they all relate together? Or don't they relate at all? What is the meaning of the different traditions in Buddhism? And that's the subject of this evening's talk. I will obviously have to address this in a historical, academic way first of all, but please don't get disappointed, because later on in the talk, as soon as I possibly can, I'm going to take this academic treatment and find its heart to wring out of it so the real truth about what's going on. And also just to see just how the right attitudes which we have to even the historic treatment of the different strands of Buddhism can also be applied to many other aspects of our life, and also our relationship to other religions, other points of view, other ways of thinking, so we can get what religions are supposed to be providing, a way forward, harmony, peace and friendship in our world. But we have to go back to the time of the Buddha, because when a Buddha became enlightened, he never taught Buddhism, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Zen, or anything. He taught what we call the Dhamma. Dhamma means the truth. And even these days, people argue about Dhamma, about how to spell it. Should it be Dharma or Dhamma? What a stupid thing to waste your time on. I don't care how you pronounce or how you spell it. But the point is, what it means is important. And this word Dhamma, what the Buddha actually found, what he taught, has incredibly rich meaning. It can mean the truth, it can mean the law, but it means that what's at the heart of things, the source, what keeps things running, what's underlying everything, and what's at the heart of you as well. Whenever we look at any experience, it's where it's coming from, what causes it, what is its source, what is it? That is the meaning of Dhamma. And that's what the Buddha taught. However, when anybody tries to explain, you know, what is as a single experience, usually gained in meditation, people start taking the explanations and the descriptions to be the real thing, the truth. And as you've heard me say here many times, the menu is not the food. The map is not the territory. The explanation is not the meaning. So a lot of times the problems come when we just take the words which the Buddha was using to describe certain events and just worship those words rather than worship what they were pointing to. But however, you do need explanations, you do need teachings, you do need words to try and explain these things. And so we start getting Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, all these little things which, you know, you read in books, which is, you say, is Buddhism. It's not Buddhism. It's not Dhamma. It's what is pointing to Buddhism, what is pointing to Dhamma. The truth is pointed or encapsulated there. It's wrapped up in there. You have to take the wrappings off and say, what does this really mean? What's it pointing to really understand what Dhamma is? Which is why that all those words and all those books, all those explanations, they are there to be contemplated upon using the power which is conferred upon every individual by deep meditation. You use a deep meditation, you've got all those teachings, you put the two together. It's called putting a match onto the gunpowder. There is a bang, enlightenment happens. For those of you who want to actually to check me out upon this, this is in the cause for seeing the Dhamma, for becoming a stream winner, a so-one. They have the two causes. They have to come together. And those two causes for seeing and penetrating the truth, seeing the Dhamma for yourself, becoming one who enters a stream, in Sri Lanka they call it so-one, is the words from another, someone else who's seen that Dhamma, the truth. That is that the map, that is the menu, that is the books, the word of another. But the other important thing for actually penetrating that truth is called, in Pali, yonisamanasikara. Literally means work of the mind which goes to the source, the essence of things. Now when you've been meditating, where are you going? You're going here, into this moment, into the silence, into the present, right into this mind, into the center of things. That's what the work of the mind is. So traditionally, in all types of Buddhism, that you have the teachings, you have the practice, when the two come together, that is where enlightenment happens. So we had these great teachings, and that was the essence of them. But what happens, like a lot of the times, people prefer to talk about Buddhism rather than practice it. They prefer to write about it and become famous rather than just sit in quiet monasteries and just disappear. And so because of that, there is lots of explanations on how to do it. Sometimes you wonder, is there too many explanations? Are there too many books in the library? Are there too many talks? I've just seen in our library, there's a whole MP3 series. I've done about 100 talks of Ajahn Brahm. My goodness, only one is enough. You've heard one, you've heard them all. That's what I say. I don't know why you keep coming, personally. But nevertheless, people love information. And because they love information, they like to listen to these teachings put in a different way, a more entertaining way. You see it from this angle, you see it from that angle. But the essence is always the same. And so because people were seeing it from different angles, we got different ways of teaching, different teachings of the Buddha and the other great teachers of that time. All, if you can really understand and penetrate it for yourself, all going to the same essence, but just from different angles. However, just what happened once the Buddha passed away, and we celebrated that last week. He did an amazing suggestion, a statement which became a rule. He said, after I pass away, there will be no leader. There will be no pope, no archbishop, no head honcho to actually to be the apex of Buddhism from here on. He said, instead, let the Dhamma, let the truth be your leader, be your teacher. Now that was a unique and powerful statement made by obviously one of the wisest, most enlightened beings who ever walked on this planet. Because at one stroke, he sort of stopped all these power games of an organized religion. So no one, no monk, no lama, no priest can actually put themselves up and say they're the head Buddhist. Because the Buddha specifically said, no way. The teacher, the leader, the peak, can never be a pope, can never be an archbishop, can never be sort of the supreme patriarch. All it can be is the Dhamma, the teaching. So straight away, it takes away, you know, from any hierarchy, any really powerful hierarchy, and gives Dhamma to where it belongs, to each individual. Nevertheless, because of human nature, there would always be people in authority, and a lot of times those people in authority, they are given that authority by their supporters. Be careful, because you make those patriarchs, not the people themselves, but you put them in those positions. And that's a dangerous thing to do. But anyhow, the main patriarch, if you like, of Buddhism wasn't actually a person. It became the Sangha, the group of monastics. And especially, there was the elite amongst the monastics. And what was that elite? Was the enlightened ones. There was a natural elitism there, and it's very hard to stop it. Those monks who were enlightened, and those nuns who were enlightened, they obviously became sort of natural authorities. If you really want to ask a question on Buddhism, on Dhamma, on meditation, who would you ask? Obviously, you want to go and ask an enlightened one, the one who has got all of the answers. Now, even though in Buddhism, the Buddha actually laid down all these rules to say, don't let anyone know if you're enlightened. Don't exhibit your psychic powers so that, you know, you sort of suppress any elitism. And even to the point that all the monks and the nuns, they wear the same type of robes. I just got a new robe. It wasn't big enough, so he put a patch on the end of it. It's a different colour. I am proud of having a patched robe. Because sometimes people think that if you become like an abbot, you have to have the lame robe. You know, the one that goes sparkles. Or at least you can have a few sort of stripes to show your authority. But if you didn't came to our monastery for the first time, you wouldn't know who was a senior monk and who was a junior monk, because we look the same. It's the same as Dharmasara as well. If you've never been to the nuns' monastery before, which one is the abbot? And that's part of Buddhism, the no hierarchy, but there was a natural tendency for the enlightened ones to be the ones who would solve all those questions. And basically that got up the nose of the ordinary monks 100 years after the time of the Buddha. Because what happened, and this is the history of why Buddhism started to split up into different sects. I don't like sects. You got that joke, very good. I won't need to explain it now. I'm celibate. But, I was meaning S-E-C-T-S. But what actually happened was, there was the age-old controversy in monasticism. The same thing happened to the Franciscans in the Catholic order. We start off being very pure, not having money. After 100 years, some of the monks said, well, it was all right in the time of the Buddha, but these are modern times. I'm talking about 2,400 years ago instead of 2,500 years ago. Things have changed, they said. And this is actually recorded, his story. And it's great to actually to see in the past, as people still get the same old arguments as they do today, that it's not practical these days. You've got to be a modern monk, 2,400 years ago, they were saying. We've got to keep money now. And the old monk said, no, you can't. It's against the rules. Now we've got to change those rules. No, you can't. And so there's a big controversy. It became what became known as the Second Council of Buddhism. And at that Second Council, they try and have some sort of vote. But they couldn't agree. In our rules, we cannot go any further unless it's unanimity. Majority doesn't work, because we realize that the minority will not be happy. Everyone eventually has to agree on a solution. It has to be in unanimity in monastic rules. So they couldn't agree, and so they decided, let's allow the arahats, the enlightened ones, to decide. So the enlightened ones decide, no, you can't have money. And that was the end of it. And all the other ones, the ordinary Joe Blow monks, they weren't happy. And especially for those students of history, this happened in the town of Vaisali, just north of Patna, north of the Ganges, in the heart of ancient Indian democracy. This was a democratic republic. For those who think democracy started in Greece, you don't know your history. There was a parallel democracies, very vibrant, long-standing and successful in India. In the time of the Buddha, they were so well established already, they had to go back much earlier in history, but we cannot find out how long. Democracy was not a Greek idea. It was parallel introduction, both in the Indian subcontinent and also in that part of Europe. But this was a democracy, and elites decided. Now, after that time, what happened, and this is history, the people who lost that argument, the ordinary monks, they started to get upset about the authority of the arahats. From that time on, you started to see people say that arahats, well, then they may be perfect in their understanding of Dhamma, but they're not always perfect in worldly things. They can make mistakes. This is actually where you started to see the denigration of the arahat, putting them in their place. And at the same time, we started to see in history of Buddhism the rise of an alternative to the arahat. Instead of becoming an enlightened one, become the bodhisattva, the one who's on the path to become enlightened, but who puts off that final enlightenment for the sake of all other beings. And this is actually where the bodhisattva starts to rise in the history of Buddhism. But there was also another movement as well, because to be an arahat was a bit hard. You know, being an arahat, you have to give up everything, and you can't sort of do this, and you can't do that. And sometimes when you're in a position of authority, they might come and ask you, Ajahn Brahma, you an arahat? Because we've heard the monastery down the road over there, they're arahats. So there's always this peer pressure. And that would also have been there at the time. It's nature. And obviously that sometimes it was just a bit too hard to actually to fulfill the goal. And so we also, there was a lot to be gained in having another goal. Saying, well, you know, I may not be an arahat, but I'm a bodhisattva. And the requirements for the bodhisattva were much less for being the arahat. So that also was a popularization. And so at that time, you can see about 3 or 4 centuries after the time of the Buddha, there's a whole new set of scriptures started to appear. And we have the start of the Mahayana tradition. Now that's actually how it started. There was a history there. And that history is important because it gives some understanding of where it came from. But you also have to understand what it means. Once you started getting it split off between the bodhisattva and the arahat, I should also mention that these were mostly sort of people who wrote the books made this separation, because that's the only reference we have in the books. And I've always noticed the ones who write the books are usually not the ones who do the practice. If you can't do it, you usually write about it. And that's why many of the books, as soon as I see these, I think, my goodness, did the fellow really know what they were talking about? And why do they do this in the first place? Now, I say that with a bit of a caveat, because I've written a couple of books. So it's not always the case that people who write books... But I'm always a bit untrustworthy of books. And you know that story which I heard from a Zen monk, and I think this is a great story, that anyone who writes a book has to spend the next 7 lifetimes as a donkey. That's the karmic result of that. Fortunately, I looked through all of the Theravada suttas. I couldn't find that anywhere, so I think I'm okay. But there is a point to that, there's a meaning to that, that sometimes the books can mislead if we just take the books to be the whole thing. So we did actually get a split which happened 2 or 3 centuries after the time of the Buddha into different schools, mostly because of people just thinking too much, writing books and arguing and not actually doing the practice, because even then it's quite clear from the evidence of that time that most of the monks, they didn't, if you don't mind me saying this, didn't give a damn what particular type of Buddhism you were, what particular type of school you were, because there was so much in common. They did the practice, they meditated, they penetrated the Dhamma, became enlightened arahats, and the enlightened ones, they had nothing to do with all of this. However, it did came down to us, because after the Muslim invasions of India, when Buddhism got fragmented, some Buddhists went over to Tibet and then into China. Some went down to Sri Lanka. Some went to Java. They went to different parts of the world. And because of their isolation, because of history, these little differences started to solidify into completely different schools. And so we did have a Mahayana the Chinese Buddhism, the Chan, Pure Land, very, very strong in China, and also the Zen, which was in Japan. We had the Vajrayana, what we now know as Tibetan Buddhism, in not just Tibet but in Mongolia and even in just the other parts of Central Asia. We had Theravada going down into Sri Lanka and over into Burma and Thailand and Cambodia. And nowadays, because the world came together, we have all these different traditions all in the same place. Isn't that wonderful? Because when we start to come together, we look at the books, and the books are slightly different. But we look at the practice, and the practice is just the same. And that's a wonderful thing, that when you start arguing with the scholars, you can argue all day and night and never get anywhere. Of whether it should be the Bodhisattva is the right way, or the Arahat is the right way. Because some people say that if you just become an Arahat, that's selfish. You don't care about anybody else. You're just becoming enlightened for yourself. You should put off your enlightenment for the sake of all other beings and be the last to become enlightened. Which, you know, being cheeky, this is not to put down Mahayana, but I thought this out many, many years ago, because I imagined, if I, like other people, put off my enlightenment for the sake of all other beings, I will not become enlightened until the last blade of grass becomes enlightened. And that's actually a vow. And I thought, what would happen then? Once all the other blades of grass and all the other people and all the other beings have become enlightened, all you'd have left was this group of bodhisattvas, all who made the same vow as I did. And I could see this great traffic jam at the end of time. Where I was saying to Manjushri, after you, and he said, no, after you, because I made the vow, yeah, but so did I, and then there's Kuan Yin as well, and there's all these other people, who's going to go first? And of course, that's only being cheeky, because that is not really what it means. And it's not being, and I've seen many people who have that degree of selflessness. I'm not concerned about myself. I'm going to serve other people. May other people become enlightened before me. That degree of selflessness, I know what that leads to. That by itself leads to enlightenment. In the same way that when, you know, all you people who have learnt meditation from me, when I teach meditation, I say, if you want to get into deep states of mind, you will never be able to. Because there's a wanting which stops. You've got to let go. Get out of the way and allow it to happen. Now you can see, if you say, I want to become enlightened, I want to get into deep meditation, it can't happen. So you can see that Mahayana mind, I'm going to let go of myself. I don't care what happens to me. That is Theravada practice. That's meditation practice. And say the Theravada practice, wanting to become enlightened. In other words, wanting to sort of be free, knowing how to be free. Then because being free can help so many other people. You can actually teach from experience. What a wonderful thing that is. So in the end, if you really want to be a bodhisattva, if you really want to serve other beings, the best thing to do is become enlightened, be an arahat. And if you really want to be an arahat, the best thing you could be is be a bodhisattva. That's the fastest way to being an arahat. Because that is what I've found. So we have this difference of opinion which people have, but these are only the scholars. And a lot of times it's the scholars who have egos. There was a Tibetan monk some years ago, he's called Chogyam Trungpa. He was a drunkard, but nevertheless he said some very wise things. And one of the wise things he said was this idea of spiritual materialism. At that time, maybe 30 years ago, when materialism was a word which was being coined, he applied it to spiritual materialism. And what spiritual materialism is just we accumulate our spiritual possessions, our spiritual capital. You know, I keep the five precepts. How many precepts do you keep? Only two. No. I'm superior than you are. But I do eight precepts. I'm much better than you are. But I do 10 precepts. I'm a disciple of this arahat. No, I'm a disciple of that bodhisattva. So a lot of times, and I'm not just joking, sometimes people get into that stuff and they think, you know, you guys are just Theravadins, you're hopeless. But if you do really, really well and you sort of complete your course under Ajahn Brahm, then you can go to the Tibetan temple and we'll give you the higher teaching. And then, once you finish the higher teaching under the Tibetans, then you can go to the Zen to get the even higher teaching, and then you can go to the higher. Again, all of that sort of stuff. Because of my Western questioning conditioning, that really just didn't make any sense to me. It wasn't Buddhist to compare yourself to other people and say, I am better than you are. However, that was part of spiritual materialism. And you can actually see that in some of the ancient texts of the scholars, not the practitioners, who even called themselves Mahayana, which means a greater vehicle. And the opposite of that was the Hinayana, which does not mean small vehicle. That is wrong Pali, it is wrong Sanskrit. Hina means gross, terrible, mean, vile, despicable. That's actually what it means. And actually recently, well not recently, a couple of years ago, I just wrote to the Oxford English Dictionary. And I put them right. I said, look, Hinayana does not mean small vehicle. And I sent them all the photocopies from the dictionaries. And they agreed. They said, wow, we didn't realize that. Thank you. So I'm a contributor to the Oxford English Dictionary. But you see, that's spiritual materialism again. But nevertheless, at least you sort of get rid of that. And so sometimes people say, well, actually, what are these yanas then? Hinayana, Mahayana, what yana is Ajahn Brahm? And you should all know by now, I am Hahayana. You've got it, you're too. That's my new yana, Hahayana. You can make it fun, and I'm not just doing this just to entertain you, because when it's fun, a lot of times the reason why people laugh is there's a point there, and religion should be fun. And it's a waste of time going to these cold churches or these dull sermons or these monasteries or something. Gives religion a bad name when it's boring. But too many young people, they don't go to religion because it's boring. You've got to make it fun, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be fun. It shouldn't be joyful. I get a lot of joy out of my meditation. I get a lot of happiness out of being a monk. This is not a boring thing to do. It's one of the best things I ever did in my life, being a monk. Wouldn't give it away for the world. Now you can see that the happiness and the joy, that's why Hahayana is a valid path. And you got Vajrayana, and you got the Zen. And a lot of times, if you hear Ajahn Brahm come up and say, myself, he say, this is the best vehicle. Don't go to that temple down the road. Don't go and practice like that. Just practice my way. This is the only way. That sort of stuff should always make you doubt. That is spiritual materialism. Each one of those paths is valid. In the same way that you can go to the different restaurants and get Thai food, Chinese food, McDonald's, or whatever else you want to eat. It's all good. It all keeps you going. It's what you do with that food is most important. So the point is, what do we do with this? Now this is actually where we stop just looking at the books. We realize what those books really mean. This is a bit of a tangent, but it's topical. Because I was reading in the paper last week, there was a huge outcry in the Muslim world because there was an accusation that the copies of the Quran had been flushed down the toilets. What would happen if you flushed down a copy of the Dhammapada down the toilet or the Tripitaka? You know what I'd do if that happened here? I'd call a plumber. Because that's a practical thing. It'll block up the sewage systems. But would I get upset and angry? Would I start a Buddhist jihad or holy war? And obviously, no, because, and I mentioned this at a talk I gave somewhere other recently, because you can flush a book down the toilet, but you're not going to flush the principles which that book embodies down my toilet. I'm not going to allow anybody to flush down peace, forgiveness, love, tolerance. That you will not flush down any toilet. You can't. Unless I allow you to. And if I do, then I'm stupid. So why do we mistake the messenger with the message. The book, they are great books, but they are just a messenger of truth. They're the messenger of peace. They're the messenger of love. They're the messenger of forgiveness. They're the messenger of understanding and peace. So why do we allow these books, or what people do to our books or to our images, to destroy what those images are really there to point to? So you all know when the Taliban destroyed those big Buddha statues in Bamiyan, I was so proud of the Buddhists for saying, oh, never mind. So you can destroy the Buddha statues, but you'll never destroy our peace and forgiveness, our sense of harmony, and our sense of friendliness to you. You can destroy all the Buddha statues you like, but you won't destroy Buddhism. You won't destroy the message which that Buddha statue is embodying, the sense of peace and forgiveness, truth, harmony. That's what's really important. And isn't that what the books are there for? So what is the message of Theravada, of Mahayana, of Zen, or whatever? They've all got these great messages. The great thing about Mahayana was that it made just compassion just so prominent. And sometimes in Theravada that was always there, but sometimes it could be forgotten because it was not prominent. So thank you for Mahayana, for actually making sort of compassion so important. Theravada, sometimes the Mahayana, they lost, you know, the idea of like a strong virtue and a commitment to the practice of meditation and simplicity. Oh, thanks for Theravada for having all these simple, direct teachings. It's great to have that. Thanks for Zen for having this one focus on meditation. Meditation, meditation is hardly anything else in Zen than meditation. Thanks for reminding us of that. Thanks for Vajrayana. Well, they do. Now they do the whole lot. Especially the great example of the Dalai Lama, just forgiveness, lost his country but gained the world. So all of these have all got things to offer to this beautiful Buddhism. So we don't compare who's the best. We just use all of this. And once you really get into this Buddhism business, you find, and this is my standard answer in brief when people say, what is the difference between Vajrayana, that's Tibetan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism of Japan, Pure Land Buddhism of China, or Chan Buddhism of China, or Theravada Buddhism, the forest tradition, Sri Lankan Buddhism, Burmese Buddhism, Vipassana, or whatever else, all these different types of Buddhism. I hope I've got most of them. They say, look, they're different types of cake. They have different icings, that's all. Underneath you've got the same cake, the Buddha cake. The icing is different. The rituals are different. Some of the ways of approaching the teachings are different. But when you follow those teachings, you find out what's going on inside. Oh, it's beautiful to see they're all the same. You know that tomorrow I'm going off to Sydney and then to Melbourne. The reason I'm going to Sydney, I'm doing a joint Waysak celebration. Just like last week we did our Waysak here. That was basically for our group. The week before, many of you know that I participated in the Waysak ceremony in Supreme Court Gardens run by the Taiwanese Mahayana group in Guildford Road, in Maylands. And it's very nice. I was there in the front seat. Sister Wayama was there also in the front seat. And we're supposed to, if you look at the books, we're supposed to be enemies. No, we're Theravada, they're Mahayana. But look, the truth of the matter is that we work together in a seamless way. And it's the same reason why I'm going to Sydney to a joint Waysak celebration. All the different Buddhist groups are going to be there. And I'm going to give one of the main speech there, which I'm very delighted to be able to have the honor to do. And then going to Melbourne to do some more sort of Buddhist stuff. So when I go traveling like this, please don't think that I'm being taken away from the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, because I get huge amounts of stories and more material, some new jokes for you. It's called research. But also, you get great opportunity to widen your contacts. And last year, I went to Japan for some ceremony. Again, this is a Pure Land temple. And so after the ceremony was finished, it put me up in this hotel and had this delegation of monks from Germany. And I've heard of one of the monks before, so they all came into my room, had this incredible, good discussion, because there were some very great German-born Tibetan monks. One of the lamas there, I really sort of respect him very highly. And we ended up talking about meditation. Now, the really deep stuff, the sort of stuff we can't talk with in public about. And we had this amazing discussion, which went on, I don't know how long into the night, about, you know, what's your meditation like? What's your meditation like? And we found that we came from completely different traditions, but all doing the same thing. And that was actually just amazing, just to see. We had these different words. But when you actually explain what those words are from experience, well, I know what you're talking about. I call it differently. And what you really found there was when you get to practitioners, people who are not just writing the books, but people who are doing it, who are actually keeping those precepts, who are actually spending years in meditation, hour upon hour, training the mind, getting deep, seeing what the Buddha saw. And you can see, my goodness, there is no difference. The difference is just on the surface. It's the icing on the cake. It could be strawberry icing, there can be chocolate icing, it could be vanilla icing. For me, I like chocolate. Tibetans like raspberry. What's the Zen grey? What's that? That's vanilla with a bit of, I don't know. Anyway, but you understand what I'm talking about. It's just different icing. You go inside, you find it is the same. And I recently gave this talk in Singapore. It was on a conference which we call Bridging the Traditions. And I said, look, it doesn't matter if you call yourself a bodhisattva or you're on the arahat path or what you're actually doing. What actually is you're doing? Not why you're doing it, but what are you doing? And for traditional Buddhists, if you are on a bodhisattva path, this is a Mahayana, which is, you know, Vajrayana is a fast part of Mahayana, so they say. If you're doing the bodhisattva practice, you're supposed to be following six paramitas, six spiritual practices. And those six spiritual practices, I'm going to rearrange them from the normal order, because I'm making a point here. The first three in my order is dana, kanti, wirya, which is dana is generosity, kanti is patience, virya is energy. And the next ones are precepts or morality, sila, samadhi, meditation, and wisdom, panya. Those are the six paramitas, the six practices of the bodhisattva in the ancient books. Generosity, patience, and energy, plus sila, samadhi, panya. Morality, meditation, and wisdom. So what do people on the arahat path, Theravada Buddhists, do? They do generosity, patience, energy, precepts, meditation, and wisdom. So they do exactly the same. Why you're doing that, you know, the purpose of it may be different. You may think, I'm doing this to get, you know, to be able to help other people. Or you may think of it, I'm doing this to become enlightened myself, to get rid of my own problems. But if you look at it, it's exactly the same. And I'll tell you why it's the same. It's because we have this dichotomy, this dualism in the spiritual world. This dualism, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but it's a powerful point. I'm going to reinforce it now. There are some people who go into the extreme of just being concerned about themselves. Coming here to get rid of your problems. Coming here to get more peace in your life, even just to lower your blood pressure. Coming here, you know, for your own benefit, maybe. Now, some of you may think you're coming here for that. Some other people are coming in here to serve for the sake of others. You've got the committee members, people like Sol, who's very, very busy, just finishing some exams, and still comes along here to serve today. There's the people on the desk over there doing the reception, the people who just actually served you with some snacks. They came here to give. They're not really concerned about themselves, they're concerned about others. Which is the right path? I mentioned yesterday, or a couple of weeks ago, that both are wrong. If you just focus on yourself, you'll miss the path. If you get dull, you just don't get any inspiration. You can't make any progress. Like, still, there's some monks in my monastery. Not in my monastery anymore, but I was talking to a monk today on the phone who still thinks that they can get into deep meditation just by staying by themselves, not giving them any talks, not serving other people. It's amazing. You can't do it. You haven't got the oomph, the energy. I've found in my own practice of over the years, almost by default, I've had to serve as a Theravada monk. You know, I had the wish just to be a hermit. That's what I like to do. That's my inclination. And people who knew me in my early life as a monk knew I just spent most of my time just in my hut. Even I did that 6-month retreat. That's where I feel at home. And I thought I was doing well. For those of you who know the history of the Buddhist Society, I came here as number 2 monk. There was another monk, Ajahn Jackrose, young, fit, very good teacher. And I thought, great, I'd be slipstreaming him for the rest of my life. What a wonderful opportunity just to be by myself. And then he went and disrobed. And all my plans went down the gurgler. So you had to serve. But one thing I found when I was serving, my meditation got really good when I started serving. And in fact, I found that, yeah, there's actually something personally beneficial to being selfless. If you just think about yourself, your meditation, your wisdom, your spiritual oomph doesn't grow. But also there are some people who just serve others. They give, 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 give. And they don't get anywhere either. It's usually burnout. They just get frustrated, disappointed, dispirited in the end. They start off with inspiration and they end with expiration. Which obviously happens after inspiration, you expire. And so people, they serve, 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 and then you don't see them anymore. They serve in our Buddhist Society committee for 1 or 2 years, and then bye-bye. And where are they gone? I never see them again. Now, both are wrong. The Dhamma, the truth, you won't see that if you focus on the other person and what their needs are. Just by giving, you will never grow. Just by thinking of yourself, you will never grow. The Buddha taught a middle path. It's not looking at the other person, nor is it looking at yourself. It's looking at the space between you. What's between you and the other person? That is where the Dhamma is seen. That is where growth happens. So the idea of being an altruist, putting off one's own enlightenment for the sake of all other beings, thinking of other beings, that never works. Thinking of yourself, just me, that never works. It's what is between us. That is what works. It's a relationship problem. It's not me. It's not you. It's us. And the same way that a person becomes enlightened, the same way they walk this Dhamma and they see this Dhamma, if it's just being selfless and doing service, if it's just being selfish, there's another alternative. What's between us? Looking at the relationship which you have with the world, the relationship which you have with yourself, the relationship you have with life. It's not the other person, it's not me, it's not the world. It's what we make of it. What's between us. And there you can see why the idea of selfish practice or not worrying about yourself, other people practice, it's still both miss the goal. So people who say the Mahayana or Hinayana or Theravada or whatever, they missed it. They will never get enlightened. In the same way, when you are watching your breath or in the present moment, it's not being in the present moment or not being in the present moment which is the problem. Having the breath in mind or not having the breath in mind, having these beautiful nimittas in deep meditation, these beautiful lights in the mind, that is not the point. It's how you are experiencing those nimittas, what's between you and that nimitta, whether there's peace there, whether there's letting go there, whether there's acceptance there. The door of my heart always open to you. Whatever it is, come in. That selflessness, that metta, that emptiness, that space, that embracing, that is not in the other person, nor is it in you. It's what is between us. Now that transcends Mahayana, Zen, Vajrayana, Theravada, all these other yanas, because that is where the practice lies. That is actually where we penetrate the truth of things. Because life is relationship. We make objects out of these things, just like we make words to describe our world. We make books to encapsulate those words, and then we fight about the books, and we get upset when a book gets destroyed or flushed down a toilet. How much do we miss things? As a Muslim, you shouldn't be concerned about Islam, nor should you be concerned about converting others. It's what's between you and the other is what's important. It's our relationships. Being a Buddhist or being a Christian, that's not the point. It's how Buddhists relate to Christians, how Christians and Buddhists, what's between them. That's the point. Now can you understand just how true religion, true understanding of all this has to create peace and harmony and stillness in this world. How it has to solve the problems. Because it's not you aren't the problem, I am not the problem. It's how we relate to each other. That will always be the problem. You can't get everybody to be like you. You can't have yourself being like other people. Isn't it wonderful that we're not the same? Remember that wonderful scene from the life of Brian? When Brian is asked to actually to say something profound, and on his balcony, thinking quickly, he said, "You are all different." And somebody put their hand up and said, "I'm not." But anyhow. So once we understand what this real Dhamma is, we can understand it has to be something, real truth, real religion, real spirituality, has to be something which doesn't create arguments in this world. And that's a dinky-dai saying of the Buddha, who said you can understand what Dhamma, what truth really is, by its effect. If it does create turmoil, it does create violence, it does create disharmony, lack of peace, then it can't be Dhamma. It's not my teachings, said the Buddha. But if it's something which creates peace and harmony and freedom, he said, now that's the teachings of a Buddha. That's Dhamma. That's truth. So if it's Theravada which says, I am better than you are, this is the original teaching, only do my way, does that create peace and harmony in the world? Of course it doesn't. So it can't be the teachings of a Buddha. If I say that, this is not the good vehicle, you should go to another vehicle, and self-deprecation, that too is not Dhamma. When we have this beautiful way of relating, relating to other religions, relating to other sects in Buddhism, relating to ourselves, relating to our meditation, relating to our body and its sickness and final death, it's not death is not the problem. If it were, we're stuck because we're all going to die. It's not cancer is not the problem. It's how we relate to that cancer. What's between us and that sickness? What's between us and the death? What's between us and life? Now, that's where the Dhamma is. And once we can work on that, that was a message in the books. That was a teaching of a Buddha. That was actually the message of a Jesus or a Prophet Muhammad or anybody. That peace in this world, and that peace is never going to be attained by just thinking of yourself or worrying about others, but looking at what's between us. It's the relationship which is important. And this is the trouble with even marriages. When you think of yourself, what I need, what I have to get out of this relationship, what my requirements are, this relationship's going to break. If you're just selfless and just think about the other person, what can I do for him, what can I give him, what can I do for her, it's going to break down. It's what's between you, how you relate together. That's where the partnership happens. So this Dhamma which the Buddha taught, not only is it for enlightenment, for seeing the deeper truths, it also makes for a happy life as a married couple. And it makes my life simple as well when you don't come up to me and say, Ajahn Brah, can you please help me? My husband's doing this, and my daughter's doing that, someone's doing this. That's why I give these talks, to somehow stop you ringing me up in the middle of the night. Because sometimes we should never publish our telephone number. Otherwise, dial a monk happens again. So anyhow, so that is the difference between these different traditions. I mentioned historical. And I mentioned just what sometimes people say they are, that we're the great vehicle, you're the small vehicle. Well, that's rubbish. Buddha only taught one vehicle. And it's not that sometimes people say that in the time of the Buddha, people weren't really intelligent enough to understand the real teaching, so they were put aside in the Naga realm, and the realm of the dragons, kept there until wise people came up in the world. That stinks, basically. It doesn't make any sense to me. One of the great things about being a Westerner, you can question, and you're allowed to question, and you're allowed to use reason, you're allowed to use historical analysis. Fortunately, after the Western Enlightenment, when people started questioning the Christian teachings, they started looking at those old teachings and using reason, science, to find out when those things were written. You can do that with Buddhist teachings as well, because language changes. If you heard a talk, even a Buddhist talk, or go and look at an old Buddhist book written 50 years ago, there are words in there you never hear today. And there are words today you never heard 50 years ago. Language changes, vocabulary changes, and you can look at an old book and you can pretty much tell when it was written, within 20, 30 years, just because of the language, the metaphors, the style, the fashion. And that's actually what they use actually to try and to date the various strands in the Christian Bible, when they were actually written. And it's very, very powerful evidence. And you can do the same with Buddhist teachings. As you see, just which ones were later, which ones were earlier. So it was great to be able to have that Western education where you could question and you could penetrate and get rid of a lot of the rubbish. But in the end, when you got rid of all the rubbish, what you were left with were these beautiful teachings of a Buddha, which are not owned by any sect, which no one has a franchise on truth. No one can patent it and say, it's mine, if you want it, you have to listen to me. The great thing about truth, it's like the air, it's there to be breathed in by any being at any time, in any place. That's why the Buddha said, Buddhas only point the way. The books only point the way. The different traditions, they just encapsulate, and because of their history, they've emphasized different parts of the way. And if you go into the heart of them, they all carry the full teachings of a Buddha. And those teachings are just the pointers for you to see these things for yourself. So, all those different jhanas, all those different traditions, it's all for you to use. But you get your meditation together as well. So with those two, the teachings of all the great traditions, or just enough sample of it to get an understanding of what it's all about, and meditate, get your mind very still. You put the two together and you understand what the Buddha was talking about. You understand the Mahayana, the Theravada, the Zen, the Vajrayana, the whole lot, and you understand, same cake, different icing, because you've got to the heart of it. And it's wonderful and beautiful you can do that, because it means, at least in our tradition, we don't have any arguments. We're not trying to, like the Catholics trying to get the Anglicans to join, and the Anglicans trying to sort of convert the Catholics. It's nice having a different cake every day, and always having the same icing. Variety is the spice of religion. So that's the talk this evening on the different Buddhist traditions, what they mean and how we can make use of this, and what's between us. That is Dhamma. So thank you for listening today. Okay, any questions, comments or complaints today? Have I offended anybody? No. Ah. Yeah. Okay, the Dharma is a living stream. Yeah, it's living in the sense. You got the point is, even like living, it just is, always is, always will be. One of the Buddha's sayings, even if Buddhas arise in the world or they don't arise in the world, the Dharma is always there. If there's a teacher or there's not a teacher, truth is truth is truth, always there to be seen. And no one owns the truth. That's why one of the biggest problems in our world, when religions or organizations come up and say, we have the only truth, all you other guys, girls have got it wrong. And it's obviously much better for our planet if we can say that this is our version of the truth. This is our explanation, our take on it, our encapsulation. This is how we describe it. But this is just descriptions. The descriptions are different, but we're pointing to the same thing. And that same thing is not a God. That's just another word. It's not like a Dhamma with an R or Dhamma with a double M. That's just words. It's actually what is underneath that, what is between us and that idea. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. You're asking, so when the Buddha wrote his Dharma and when Ajahn Chah, he never wrote a thing, Ajahn Chah. That's why he will never get reborn as a donkey. It is other people. And actually, I know some of the monks who wrote those books, and they don't want to disrobe because they weren't meditating, they were spending all their time translating. It's true. But anyhow, sort of they wrote down those things, and that's his explanation, that's his description of the same thing. And so we don't argue about who is right and who is wrong. If you argue, then you are wrong. If you're friends, then you are right. Okay, so thank you for coming today. And I will be here next week when I come back from Sydney and Melbourne and Canberra. So I hope to see you next week. But next week is a long time. There are some messages for even what's going to happen tomorrow and on Sunday. So take it away, Sol.